Okay, last week we began discussing the idea of the mitzvah of emunah and the importance of proving the existence of the Ribono Shel Olam and the like. I'd like to continue that this week. First, very briefly, with just a couple of minutes on the Rambam's proofs, and then turning to how one deals with the issue of Emunah Bizman Hazet, is it any different than it was during the Tkufa the Rishonim? So if you turn to your source sheets on page 5, last time we saw how Avram Avinu came to an understanding that HaKadosh Baruch Hu exists, because after all, how is it possible for the sphere to revolve without anyone controlling it? Surely, if it's moving, there must be a manhig. We noted how the Medrash has Avram Avinu doing a similar type of argument. And Rambam, in fact, in the Mor Nevuchim, presents 4 proofs for the existence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. One of the 4 proofs is what he says very briefly in what we saw last week, the idea that he is Shagalgal Soviv Tamid, V'ef Sharshi Yasuv Belo Misavev. It's interesting that he picks that particular one for the Mishneh Torah. Presumably that's because it's the simplest one. So therefore, in the Mishneh Torah, where he doesn't elaborate, so he picks the very simplest proof. Now, where are the proofs? So there are in the whole proof is in the beginning of the second part of Mor Nevuchim, and he lays out the proof in 26 steps, and he prefaces the proof with 25 metaphysical and physical propositions, which he writes, all of which have been proven. All 25 of these have been proven. And then he begins, and before, then he notes there's a 26th proposition, which he thinks is wrong, but he's going to say it anyway. What is that proposition? The eternity of matter. So why would the Rambam prove something based off of a proposition that he thinks is false? So he writes the following. Take a look, page 5. 25 of the positions which are employed in the proof for the existence of God or in the arguments demonstrating that God is neither corporeal nor a force connected with a material being or that he is one have been fully established and their correctness is beyond doubt. Aristotle and Persepolis, who followed him, have proven these propositions. There is, however, one proposition which we do not accept, namely the proposition which affirms the eternity of the universe. But we will admit it for the present, because by doing so, we shall be enabled to clearly demonstrate our own theory. Basically, Aristotle believed in the eternity of matter. That means that matter always existed. This was widely accepted in medieval times, and in fact, if you note that the Rambam here, as well as in a number of other places, as well as the Ramban frequently. In the Ramban, for example, we read last week from Anochi, stress that one of the principal hashkafos that the Torah tries to prove is Bria Yesh Me'ayin, and it tries to show the importance. So last week we saw the Ramban note how the existence of miracles demonstrates that there must be Bria Yesh Me'ayin, because miracles aren't compatible with the notion of the eternity of matter, at least as Aristotle finds it. That point is actually one which the Rambam made earlier, and the like. So, the Rambam thinks, he calls Bria Yesh Me'ayin, Yesod Torah Moshe Rabbeinu Olav HaShalom, Beli Safek, V'yishniya Li Yesod HaYichud. Right up there in terms of important Ikare Hadas is Bria Yesh Me'ayin. It's one of the Yud Gimel Ikare Emuna. Interestingly enough, in his earlier formulation, he didn't stress it as much, but in the second formulation of the Ikare Emuna, which you could see in the Kapach edition of the Perusha Mishnayos, it's one of the Ikare Emuna. And so the question is, why does he assume what he thinks to be his kfira in order to prove the existence of God? So the answer is very simple. If you believe in Briah Yesh Me'ayin, so then you certainly believe in the existence of God. After all, what was the cause of this Briah Yesh Me'ayin? Rambam is saying, even if you reject Briah Yesh Me'ayin and you accept Aristotle's belief, which I think is false, I can still prove to you that God exists. And therefore, it's a powerful proof because it's accepting the hanachos of those who disagree with him and saying, even according to your hanachos, I can show that God exists. Obviously, if you believe in Briah Yesh Me'ayin, you certainly agree that God exists. But even if you deny Briah Yesh Me'ayin, I could still show you that God exists. Moreover, the Rambam notes that Briah Yesh Me'ayin is something that cannot be proven. Even though the Rambam thinks it's true, and it's the pina upon which the Torah rests, it's nevertheless cannot be proven, at least in a philosophical or scientific syllogistic fashion, in the way that God could be proven. Now, as we noted last week, just because you can't prove something in that way, it doesn't mean it's not rational to believe in it. And in fact, when Rambam goes through the various possibilities of Briyas Olam, or how matter exists, he notes that even from a purely scientific perspective, the possibility of Briah Yesh Me'ayin is the more compelling option, but it can't be proven. And therefore, the Rambam says, I want to prove that God exists based off of propositions which could be definitively proven. So the Rambam believed in Briah Yesh Me'ayin. The fact that he presumes the eternity of matter in his proof for God doesn't indicate that he doesn't believe in Briah Yesh Me'ayin, but rather he's saying, Ki'ilu lishitascha, I could still prove that HaKadosh Baruch Hu exists. And this point is made on the bottom of page 5 from chapter 71. We'll just read the bolded section. I'm only stressing it because I think there are many people make a mistake about this point. I do not propose this method as though I believed in the eternity of the universe, for I do not follow the philosophers on this point, but because by the aid of this method, these three principles, namely the existence of God, His unity, and His incorporeality, can be fully proved and verified, irrespectively of the question of whether the universe had a beginning or not. After firmly establishing these three principles by exact proof, we shall treat the problem of creation and discuss it as fully as possible. So first he's going to prove God, His unity, His incorporeality, and then he's going to say, later on, I'll show you why I think that the correct belief is Briyas HaOlam as well. Skip to the next paragraph, you'll see an interesting point. For this reason you will find in my works on the Talmud, whenever I have to speak of the fundamental principles of religion, or to prove the existence of God, that I employ arguments which imply the eternity of the universe. What's he referring to when he writes his works in the Talmud? He's referring to the Perash Mishnayos as well as the Mishnah Torah. Where does he assume the eternity of matter there? So just, for example, in the Mishnah Torah, which we read last week, he kept on reading, using the words Hagalgal Sovev Tamid, which indicates that it's eternal. And he's saying that I'm going to assume that only for the purposes of proving, but not that that's my actual belief. Okay, so what are these proofs? So I'm not going to try to explain them to you, A, due to their complexity, B, due to the fact that I don't really understand them anyway. But each of the four proofs begins basically with some type of observed characteristic in the world, and then invokes the principle of an infinite regress to show that it must start with something. And that first cause has to relate to God. So the first proof is derived from motion, the second proof from the composition of the elements, the third proof from necessity and contingency, and the fourth from potentiality and actuality, or causality. There is one proof that some people think is an ontological proof, but the pashup shot is that they're all teleological, or actually cosmological proofs. We won't get into those distinctions now. Rav Tursky actually thinks, he gave last year in one of his post-Mincha Shurim, tried to read the Rambam in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, showing that there's both a cosmological and teleological proof in what Avraham Avinu said. The third one? The first is from motion, the second is from the composition of the elements, the third is from necessity and contingency, and the fourth from potentiality and actuality. Now, the first proof is summarized over here by Professor Hyman, who I was zocha to study Mor Nevuchim with a little bit. And so if you're interested in a brief summary, it's on the bottom of page 6, going on to page 7, and Ayin Shum, if that interests you. Now, a couple of points should be noted. Number one, even as the Rambam advocates for the importance of being able to prove God's existence, he does not claim that philosophical proof is necessary for basic fulfillment of the mitzvah of Anochi. He emphasizes this point in Mor Nevuchim, and you could see this on page 7, chapter 50, section 1. Here, the Rambam begins, first of all, by noting that simply saying something is not the same thing as knowing it. And this is something which is very important. The Rambam writes, when reading my present treatise, bear in mind that by belief, we do not understand merely that which is uttered with the lips, but also that which is apprehended by the soul. The conviction that the object of belief is exactly as it is apprehended. Meaning to say, some people claim, the Rambam writes, that simply stating your belief is enough to fulfill this mitzvah of emunah. So if you say Shema, that's sufficient. The Rambam writes, as if the object of the law of the Torah was to seek forms of expression, not subjects of belief. The Rambam writes, this is wrong, because for belief is only possible after the apprehension of a thing. It consists in both the conviction that the thing apprehended has its existence beyond the mind in reality, exactly as it's conceived in the mind. In other words, if you just say something without understanding what you're saying or its implications, then that's meaningless. It's saying something that doesn't make sense to you or that you don't understand. The Rambam writes that that includes understanding the corollaries of what you're saying. So, for example, the Rambam writes that a corollary to God's oneness is that God has no attributes. What do we mean by God's having not attributes? So attributes, I don't want to go into this topic at length. It's a very difficult topic. But the Rambam shows both in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah as well as in greater length in the Mor Nevuchim that attributes are problematic for a number of reasons. If these attributes are accidental qualities, so then they could imply that God can change. If you say God was kind and then God is jealous, so that means he's changed, which is clearly a contradiction to Achdus Hashem. Because, moreover, it's also a problem because it implies he's in some way imperfect, such that he needs to change. Even unchanging attributes contradict oneness because they introduce an aspect of multiplicity. There's God and his attributes, which is a contradiction to the simplicity of Achdus Hashem. And if you imply that they are part of him, then you're implying that they're multiple parts to him. If you imply that they're not part of him, so then you're saying there's something besides him. There's him and his attributes, both of which contradict Achdus Hashem. Because Achdus Hashem means Hashem is simple, meaning to say not comprised of multiple parts, so there can't be him and his attributes. And Achdus Hashem also, like we saw last week, means Ein Od Milvado. There's nothing besides him. So to say there's him and attributes outside of him is also a stira. So the Rambam says, therefore, understanding Achdus Hashem means the recognition of the fact that attributes are false. Now, the Rambam, of course, deals with the fact that the Torah does refer to God using attributes. How are we to understand them? Attributes sometimes reflect action. They don't reflect his essence. They're depictions of how he acts. He talks about them in ways similar to the way he deals with anthropomorphisms, which we dealt with earlier in the year. Now's not the time to get into it. The point, though, that we have to understand is that the Rambam writes, those who believe that God is one and he has many attributes declare the unity with their lips and assume plurality in their thoughts. Because if he's Echad, he doesn't have attributes. If you think he's Echad and he has attributes, and you say Shema, but you believe he has attributes, so there's a stira between what you're saying and what you actually believe. He goes so far as to say that saying he is one but has attributes is like the doctrine of the Christians who say that he is one and he is three, and that the three are one. In other words, makes no sense. So what then is necessary to be Mekayim Anochi? So the Rambam says you have to have a correct conception of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He writes, for belief is only possible after the apprehension of a thing. It also, so number one, you have to understand. Number two is you have to have certainty. Take a look, next passage on page seven. Belief is only possible after the apprehension of a thing. It consists in the conviction that the thing apprehended has its existence in reality exactly as it is conceived in the mind. If in addition to this we are convinced that the thing cannot be different in any way from what we believe it to be, and that no reasonable argument can be found for the rejection of the belief or for the admission of any deviation from it, then there is certainty. So it is possible to have certainty without formally being able to prove it. So the Rambam says that certainty is necessary. However, ideally, a person should, in fact, strive for proof. And if you want to be able to prove it, it's not just enough to study philosophy. But the Rambam writes, to renounce desires and habits, follow your reason and study what I'm going to say. You have to not just be osek in Chachma, but you actually have to be Poresh from Olam Hazeh, the extent to which we are tied to the physical limits our ability to apprehend the spiritual. Now, yes? Not comprised of multiple parts. Just take a look for a basic understanding of that. Read the Yud Gimel Ikar Yemuna in the Rambam's Hakdama to Perek HaChelek, where the Rambam sets out, he also does it in Hilchos Tshuva, but I think the best place to start for that is over there, where he gives a basic definition of what Achdus Hashem means. Yes?
Apprehending God means knowing the nature of God, but not necessarily being able to prove that God exists.
I don't know if I would say knowing the nature. That's going a little far. We can't know the nature
right.
of God.
What is it?
But understanding that he exists and what he is on a basic level. We'll try to expand on this. I'll just make a ha'ara, which is Rav Kook notes that he believes the source of atheism is a misunderstanding or an immature definition of what God is. We all go ahead and we first learn about God when we're 3 years old. Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is everywhere. And many people retain that immature understanding of what Hashem is throughout their lives. And the cause for atheism is because they become more intelligent and sophisticated in other aspects, but they have this simplistic and even false image of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is. I don't know, an old man sitting on a throne in heaven. Even if they wouldn't put it that way, fundamentally, that's what they think. And so, as somebody else put it, the God they reject is not the God that I believe in either. So, a correct understanding of the Ribbono Shel Olam is very important. Now, before we get to, again, the Bizman Hazeh, I just want to note, yes, last week we noted how the Rambam does think that belief in Hashem is a mitzvah. Not everybody agrees to that. The Behag omits the mitzvah, and the Ramban in his Hasagos to Sefer Mitzvos defends the view of the Behag, though as we noted last week, that's not his own view. And one of the strongest challenges to Rambam's Shita that belief is a mitzvah was posed by Rav Chasdai Kreskes in the Sefer Or Hashem, and essentially his if you look to the supplemental source sheet that I gave out last week, you'll see it. It's starting on the bottom left of page 1 and continues to page 2. But essentially, Rav Chasdai Kreskes has three rationales for rejecting Rambam's view. Number one, commanding faith doesn't seem to make sense. If I already believe, then the commandment is superfluous. And if I don't believe, so then I will take no heed to such a commandment. Number two, beliefs cannot be fully commanded since they are not voluntary. In other words, either I do or I don't. It's not something that I could choose to do. A mitzvah is something that has to be voluntary, he assumes. And finally, number three is he thinks that the Rambam's proof from the Gemara in Makos is not correct. So last week we talked about how I think there is no doubt that the simple understanding of the Gemara in Makos does support Rambam's view. We dealt with the Ramban's proof from the Kasha from the Gemara's Makos and how the Rambam would answer that. But returning to the first couple points, so I think what has to be kept in mind is that the Rambam's understanding of Anochi is not just passive belief, but again, it demands that a person search. And even if a person already believes, that he seeks to strengthen his belief. That's the first point. The second point is that the Rambam very much believes that a person is drawn after false ideologies, not simply as a result of intellectual errors, but because a person allows themselves to be tempted by these false beliefs. Just a couple of minutes ago, we read about how the Rambam writes that if you want to come to proof for God's existence, you have to be porish from the world. And again, you could ask, well, what's the logic? In other words, if this is purely a intellectual issue, so then why is it relevant how much dessert I eat? But the answer is, the Rambam writes, for example, that the Pasuk tells us, "V'lo sasuru acharei levavchem ve'acharei einechem." And we know the Gemara tells us, and it's paskened in the Rambam in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, that "lo sasuru acharei levavchem ve'acharei einechem" is, among other things, telling us not to stray after minas. A person has the ability to allow themselves not to let these false beliefs take root in their heart. If we look back at the Rambam that we read last week from Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah Perek Aleph Halacha Vav, the Rambam writes, "V'yedias davar zeh mitzvah saseh shenemar anochi Hashem Elokecha v'chol hama'aleh al da'ato sheyesham Eloha acher chutz mizeh over belo saseh shenemar lo yeloch Elohim achirim al panai." So if you're ma'al al da'ato, if you permit the thought to enter your mind that another deity exists, so then you're over on lo yelecha. I'd like to return to this point in a couple of minutes, but the Rambam here is telling us that many of the questions that lead a person to question belief are not rooted in intellectual problems, but are coming from something else, whether it's too strong of a connection to Olam Hazeh, or psychological issues, or emotional issues, or the like. And a person has a degree of control over these thoughts, and therefore the Torah says, "V'lo sosur acharei levavchem v'acharei einechem." We'll return to this point, hopefully today, when we have a little more background. One other ha'ara is that although Rambam and Rabbeinu Bachya and Chovos HaLevavos and the Sefer HaChinuch and many other Rishonim advocate for seeking proof, there are dangers as well. One obvious reason is that if I fail in my pursuit of proof, then I could be led to denial. If I simply believe based off of Mesorah, so I'm safe. If I go ahead and look for some type of proof, and then I fail to find a proof that convinces me, so then I'll be left with doubt. Now, the Rambam felt that anyone who properly seeks proof and is properly prepared will not come to that conclusion if they're honest. But still, it's surely a danger. Another danger with respect to proofs, we'll see more when we do Kuzari Be'ezras Hashem next week, is that an intellectual knowledge of God's existence is not the same thing as a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the Torah wants us to have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And focusing so much on proof and these intellectual aspects of knowing Him takes away from the Ribbono Shel Olam. And we'll elaborate on that next week. There's a famous quote that the Rav likes to bring from a Kierkegaard, that you could go ahead and be looking for proofs and this and that. If you're embraced by your lover, so you don't have any doubt that they exist. And the pursuit of proofs leaves one, or can leave one, with a very dry connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And again, we'll return to that next week. There's a famous historical observation made by the Chassid Yavetz. The Chassid Yavetz lived from 1440 to 1508, not to be confused with Rav Yaakov Emden, and he was among those who were expelled from Spain in 1492. And he notes that among people who were put to the ultimate test, so those whose faith was rooted in philosophical proof, they were toppled. He compares that to people with many branches but shallow roots. And those, the faith of the ignorant, which he compares to people with a tree with the deep roots but few branches, remained steadfast. And it was they who were willing to pay the ultimate sacrifice, whether it was life or fortune, for our Kodesh Baruch Hu. So history has shown us that proof does not always yield conviction. Rav Huttner writes, that's the reason why we teach a child to say Shema, because well before the child's able to understand the philosophical implications of the verse, what we just saw from the Rambam, that Shema implies a lack of attributes, but we want to entrench emuna in the child. And then, perhaps later on, from a perspective of strong strength, he can go ahead and look for proof or the like. And the same thing is stressed by all thinkers that advocate proof. Look, for example, in the Chovos HaLevavos, in his Hakdama, where he makes this point that, yes, it is valuable to have proof, and he does that in the Shaar Bechina, as well as the Shaar HaYichud, but that's something that a person should pursue after being fully grounded. Now, of course, you could say, well, is that being intellectually honest? So we're going to return to that question in just a couple of minutes. So now I'd like to turn to the issue of proof bizman hazeh. In the past, in this shiur, I haven't necessarily focused on doing this together. I'm a bit nervous about what we're about to work on. But I think it's important, not necessarily that everybody study this, but certainly those of you, even if you're already very firm in your belief, if you're becoming Rabbanim or Mechanchim, people will come to you with questions all the time. And it's important to be able to respond in a way that shows conviction and certainty and sophistication and the like. Oftentimes, when you're able to have that confidence, you don't even need to actually respond, because what emerges is that a lot of times the questions don't actually stem from purely intellectual issues. But if you can't first address, or at least be willing to address them, then you won't be able to get to that next step. I also preface what we're about to do with the fact that some of the things I'm going to say and I'm going to talk about are in matters that I don't know much about. I'm not a scientist, not a philosopher, and hopefully what I say is going to be accurate, and I'm not going to misrepresent it, but I don't want to pass myself off as an expert. I don't think I'm an expert in anything, but certainly not in the topics that I'm going to discuss now. And finally, most of the points that I'm going to say can be elaborated upon at length, and if anybody would like some elaboration, especially on some of the points relating to science or the like, I could talk to you about it. I could do more Marimakomos on the topic, but I think for purposes of today, we're going to have to be somewhat superficial, but these things can, and maybe even oversimplify, but these things can be elaborated upon. So, there have been some religious thinkers, very firm thinkers, who have basically conceded that in the post-Kantian world, proof is no longer possible. Basically for two reasons. The first stems from the philosophical rejection of the medieval proofs. In the 18th century, philosophers attacked the viability of the cosmological proof. David Hume questioned both the presumption of causation assumed in the argument and causal principle, namely that every contingent being has a cause of its being that lies in the heart of the argument. Later, Kant averred that the cosmological argument rests upon an ontological argument, which he questions. And moreover, there are those who have pointed out that contemporary science has offered an alternative solution, something like evolution, which they claim argues the possibility of our world existing without there being a God, chas v'shalom. Now, the Rambam himself notes that it is important to accept that some things are true, even if they cannot be proven. Take a look at the passage from Mor Nevuchim, top of page 7. The same thing is the case with the speculative faculties. If you admit the doubt and do not persuade yourself to believe that there's a proof for things that cannot be demonstrated, we'll go into the details, but the Rambam says don't try to prove things that can't be proven. We have to acknowledge our intellectual limitations. And while Rambam certainly did feel that the existence of God could be proven, perhaps that's no longer the case, in which case the basis of our belief will no longer be the types of philosophical proofs that Rambam argues. Now, that doesn't mean that belief in God is not rational or psychologically compelling. It is. It just means that the types of proofs offered by the medieval thinkers are no longer relevant. So, just to stress, even those in this first school of thought have not claimed, and nobody, I think, reasonable would ever think that philosophy or science has in any way refuted the existence of God. All they claim is that you can't turn to philosophy for a definitive proof as one once could. And thus, for example, the Rav, who seems to more or less have been in this first school of thought and maintained that proof is no longer possible, writes, "I've never been seriously bothered by the theory of scientific story of evolution on both cosmic and organic levels." It's not that there was any, he didn't think that science in any way posed a challenge. He just thought that you couldn't look to science for proof in the same way. So that's essentially the first school of thought. The second school of thought say that we shouldn't give up so easily. And we could still turn to science and philosophy to demonstrate that, at the very least, the most reasonable worldview, insofar as it's the only worldview that could explain everything that we observe, is the existence of God. And while some of the arguments, as we shall see, might lack some of the elegance of the medieval syllogistic proofs, there is nevertheless powerful evidence from science for the existence of God. So let's start for a moment with the cosmological argument. While it might need some reformulation from the way that Rambam presented it, I'll get to you afterwards. But it's interesting, in a sense ironic, that modern physics in many ways is much more compatible with the existence of God than even traditional physics. And that brings us back to the point that we just mentioned a couple of minutes ago. Namely, the Rambam noted that he has to prove the existence of God from a milieu in which the mainstream philosophical understanding was the eternity of matter. Nowadays, with the widespread acceptance of the Big Bang, everybody more or less concedes that there was a beginning. And they reject Aristotle's model. Something started it. There was the Big Bang theory describes what happened and how that developed from T equals 1. But what about T equals 0? There is a T equals 0. As opposed to the Aristotelian conception. And thus, in a sense, it's much easier to prove the existence of God. And it's very important to remember that with all that science has taught us, there are still many questions that can't be answered without resorting to God. First and foremost, why does anything exist? What started the process that caused our universe to come into existence? Again, the Big Bang doesn't answer that. The Big Bang deals with what happened after the beginning. But why? What started it? What caused the Big Bang? And even more basic, why does anything exist? Why should there be existence? There's no answer to that. Likewise, people refer to evolution. Evolution seeks to explain how life on Earth could naturally evolve. Whether you like it or not, that's what it seeks to explain. But it doesn't explain why Earth exists, why there's anything on Earth, why the materials that evolved into human life, why they're there. Now, one response to this argument is to say, well, there might have been something before our universe. Dr. Stephen Hawking, proposes that perhaps our universe is part of something much larger, perhaps infinitely large, something that he calls a multiverse. So our universe is part of something bigger. So what caused the Big Bang? Something outside of our universe. Essentially, it's a way to try to go back to the Aristotelian model that something always existed. So there might have been many Big Bangs, each one that led to the other. However, if you accept that, a tougher problem still looms. So what is the source for these ingenious laws of physics that allow one Big Bang to sprout another Big Bang to sprout another Big Bang in infinite regression? Why does anything exist? This question, this theory of the multiverse, essentially just kicks the can down the road. Okay, so what caused our universe? Something else. Or it's part of something bigger. Well, why is that there? That's one problem. The second problem is, even from a scientific perspective, there's no evidence for these additional universes. Additional universes, should they exist, lie beyond our powers of observation, and at least for the foreseeable future, are not even theoretically investigable. And hypothesizing that they might exist, to answer this question, is basically scientists setting aside the general need for experimental confirmation, and they're just basically going ahead and saying, well, it's true, I have no indication that any of this exists, but there's no other explanation for the cause of why something exists, so there must be something else that exists that caused this to exist, that triggered its existence. Now, even if you were to get over that hump and, well, let's actually say one other thing. So now you could say, well, no, you're trying to prove, I'm trying to prove from the argument, who is the designer of the design, right? So something must have started it all. So I'm saying that something is God. And they'll say, okay, that something is some other universe that might exist, or multiverse, or the like. And I'm saying that there's something that always existed that started it all, namely HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And they're saying there's something that always existed that is the cause, namely this multiverse, or whatever it is. So why is my argument any better than theirs? This point was more or less made by David Hume. Richard Dawkins, in his book The God Delusion, makes a big deal out of it. He calls it the ultimate Boeing 747 gambit. There's a lot of ways of phrasing this argument. But the Chazon Ish actually addresses this point. And if you take a look, it's on page 8 in your source sheets. This is from Sefer Emunah and Bitachon. And the Chazon Ish writes that, read it together. V'yesh mi balei dimyon hasho'alim ma narviach im naskim shiyesh la'olam mamtzi acharei shehinenu mochruchim laskim shebore olam nimtza vein eis la'haschalaso umitziuso nitzchis v'harei hadra koshi l'duchta eich efshar l'nimtza below havaya. Exactly this question. Aval eim l'dimyon bina ki kol nimtza sheyesh lo midah v'ketzev orech v'shetach anu mitzayrim b'da'atenu ha'adro v'chol ha'nimtzaim b'sug hazeh be'achreach sheyesh eish l'mitziusam. When we're dealing with something that's physical, that has mass, size, shape, so then there must have been a beginning. V'yesh l'maschala v'chol sheyesh lo haschala yesh lo havaya, v'chol sheyesh lo havaya, yesh lo mehaveh. Things of this sort are subject to decomposition and the like. So there must have been a beginning. And if there was a beginning, there must be a creator. Aval yesh nimtzaim she'in lahem lo midah v'lo shetach v'hei nimtzaim b'chiyuv. There are certain types of things that are necessarily existent or necessarily true. Not because they were created, but because they simply are. V'lo yitzayer b'hem hader, v'hein amuskalos. Their lack of existence is inconceivable. And these are what we call muskalos. Kimo, Beis pa'amim beis heim dalet. 2 times 2 is 4. It's actually a debate among this among mathematicians, but for now, it doesn't really matter. So, why is 2 plus 2 4? It's not because it was created. That's something that's simply necessarily true. And therefore, it could always have existed. Ukumo amuskal she'alachson odefal ha'orech ukiyotze bahen min amuskalot she'en la muskal musagim mumusagei guf ve'en eis lemitziusan ve'lo noldu me'olam ve'lo yamusu li'olam ve'en mitziusan nirgashos rak b'neshama she'nitan la'adam la'avin u'la'askil ve'nimtza kazeh hu mitziuso yisborach. Mamti kol hanimtzaim, ach ein li yitzur shum musag mimahuso, ki hu yisborach bal koach uval bechira, yodea kol yitzura v'yodea maaseyem, v'yodea tzura sorcham, etc., etc. Essentially, what the Chazon Ish is saying is that physical things are limited by space and time, and thus they must have a beginning. Non-physical things need not have a beginning. And therefore, it's fundamentally different. There's a fundamental difference between saying God is the cause for all that exists and he always existed, and saying simply that, well, there must have been some other physical cause for the physical world or universe, such as the multiverse, because a physical thing needs to be created, whereas a necessary and non-physical being can exist forever. Now, even if one gets over the hump of why anything exists, there are also numerous things that evolution cannot really explain. There is, for example, no evidence for the possibility that life can evolve from non-life, or atomate from inanimate. Now, I'm aware of the experiment, the bowl, the soup, and the like, but even if you accept the validity of that experiment, in which a electric current ran through a soup of organic molecules and formed amino acids, that existence of the formation of amino acids is very different than life. And as far as I could tell, and again, I'm not an expert, there really is no explanation of how you could go from non-life to life. Likewise, there's no theory that explains, as far as I could tell, the evolution of consciousness. Now, this type of evidence has been rejected by atheists, people like Richard Dawkins, who call this type of argument the God of the gaps. What does he mean to say? Well, your existence of God is simply the gaps in which science can't explain. So there's a gap, okay? We can't explain the evolution for consciousness. So therefore, how do I know that God exists? Because there's this thing, this phenomena, that science can't explain. And therefore, he says, that's very weak, because science is progressing every day, and the gaps are getting smaller every day, and one could say, he claims with near certainty, that sooner or later, all those gaps will be plugged. So, I think that's a pretty flimsy argument. First of all, these gaps are not minor holes, but they're major questions that science does not even appear to be on the verge of explaining. Like we said before, there's no model to answer these questions. Why anything should exist at all? Why, how life could form from inanimate to atomate, and the like. We mentioned before the Chazon Ish. Take a look at the Chazon Ish and how he presents the idea of emuna in the modern world. When you read the Chazon Ish and Emuna and Bitachon, you discover a whole nother facet of the Chazon Ish that perhaps you wouldn't necessarily get from reading his halachic works, and it's breathtaking. Another straightforward response to the God of the Gaps objection, I thought was formulated nicely in a recent New York Times interview. It's on page 8, from Dr. Alvin Plantiga. Some atheists seem to think that a sufficient reason for atheism is the fact, as they say, that we no longer need God to explain natural phenomena. Lightning and thunder, for example. We now have science. As a justification of atheism, this is pretty lame. We no longer need the moon to explain or account for lunacy. It hardly follows that belief in the non-existence of the moon is justified. Amoonism, on this ground, would be sensible only if the sole ground for belief in the existence of the moon was its explanatory power with respect to lunacy. And even so, the justified attitude would be agnosticism with respect to the moon, not amoonism. The same thing goes with belief in God. Atheism on this sort of basis would be justified only if the explanatory power of atheism were the only reason for belief in God. And even then, agnosticism would be the justified attitude, not atheism. Now, in this article, Plantiga notes a large number, he says maybe a couple dozen, of pretty good theistic arguments, and he claims that while none of them is absolutely conclusive, each, or certainly all of them taken together, is about as strong of a philosophical argument that one gets. Now, a person might go ahead and say, I still want definitive proof. And whatever sorts of evidence we've argued for in the last couple minutes, such a person would say, this isn't definitive proof. So, if a person has that attitude, they have to ask themselves whether really being epistemologically consistent. Is that the attitude that you have with respect to other questions? Do you always demand absolute definitive proof in order to believe that something exists? I think a lot of times that question comes from an inconsistency or perhaps other motivations for demanding this sort of proof. If you want to take a look, we don't have time to do it today, but there's a book by Richard Swinburne. Part of it is cited at the bottom of page 8, where he makes this proof at length. And you could read a passage along these lines, bottom of page 8, towards the top of page 9. So, to summarize, what have we seen so far? This second school of thought maintains that A, they're reasonable, if not perhaps absolutely conclusive, arguments for the existence of God, and B, the demand for absolute proof is not epistemologically warranted, especially in light of the other options. To these two points, Plantiga adds a third point. I don't think, it's on top of page 9, I don't think these arguments are needed for rational belief in God. In this regard, belief in God is like belief in other minds, or belief in the past. The same type of people that question the belief of God in philosophical, based off philosophical arguments, also question those types of things, like the past. Belief in God is grounded in experience. This is a point that we really need to develop now, which I think is the most important aspect and the most important basis for why we believe in God. The types of scientific and philosophical arguments that we've presented until now are important, but ultimately they are only a small part of something which is much bigger. Belief in God, next week, by the way, by way of advertisement, So Rav Aaron Lapiansky will be here Be'ezras Hashem. I highly, highly, highly recommend anyone who can stay for Shabbos to do so. He's going to be speaking several times over Shabbos Friday night, a Parsha Shir and a Chal Shudis. So anyway, I once remember discussing a point with him. Also, by the way, another Mar Makom, he has a series of lectures that you could find on the internet entitled Dama Lahashiv, and they deal with a lot of these questions as well. Proof, evidence in today's world, questions from science and the like. They're incredible. They're a series, I think, about 45 or 50 lectures on these topics. If you do want to see more on the topic, I would recommend looking there. But anyways, I was saying once, I remember in discussing the matter with him, so he said that something like asking me about why I believe is like asking me why I love my wife. It's so much more than any particular argument. So you could give one argument, you could give a scientific argument, why does anything exist, philosophical arguments and the like. But all these are really small aspects of something which is much bigger. And the sum is really much greater than any of its parts. And while today we began looking at some of the parts, it's also important to remember that you have to look at the sum. Now, what we haven't done today, and I guess I was hoping to, but we'll have to turn to next week, is non-philosophical, scientific reasons to believe in God. What we saw last time being referred to as experiential reasons. In truth, I believe that these types of arguments are really much more powerful than the types of arguments that we've been given today, and we'll have to wait till next week till we could get there. But I'll just close with one other hara. We've been focusing on science and philosophy. It is also important to turn to history as well. History is really one of the most powerful things. Anyone who studies history honestly, whether it's looking at the Ashkacha that's clearly manifest in Jewish history, our return in modern times to Eretz Yisrael, and the modern history, or the like, that is something that's really overwhelming. Rav Tzadok, take a look over here on page 9, writes, V'lo mi'atzias Mitzrayim bilvad yuchal ha'adam lahavchin v'ladas birur ha'emuna, like we talked about last week, that Yetzias Mitzrayim is in fact a basis for our belief, but not that alone. Fundamentally, seeing God in history is not different than seeing God in any other aspect of nature. And in fact, when you do think about it, it does serve to be one of the most powerful, powerful aspects of emuna. Okay, so we'll stop here, and Be'ezras Hashem, we'll pick up next week. Continuing this topic and focusing on the Kuzari as well.